You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, a man who has yet to receive his stimulus check from the IRS, despite everything being in order for this. For those of you who have given me a few bucks out of yours, I thank you very much. You're the only reason that I can continue to function. But when I finally get this thing, if it ever happens, you will be the first to know. We are still in the Paschal season. It is the 5th of May, 6th of May, I should say. This is being recorded on the 5th, 2020. And we're going to talk about something that has nothing to do with COVID-19. I am so sick of that topic. We're going to talk about something near and dear to my heart, something that I call the decline and rebirth of Moscow during the 16th and 17th centuries. What could be more relevant to our present situation? Well, some of my students at the universities, I've taught as said many times, I could make anything relevant to our day. I could connect anything to anything, which is what a good lecturer does. The reason I talk about this era, and I've spoken about it many, many times, whether it be at the university, through tutoring, online, and in broadcasting, is because it's one of the critical times in European history. It's critical, what we call basically early to mid-modernity, just after the Baroque era, you know, for lack of a better way to put it. But more so even for Russia. So everything that happened afterwards was really an unfolding of what occurred in the 16th and 17th centuries. So, at the end of the 15th century, up to the middle of the 16th, the Russian state was united under Ivan III. We're talking about the birth of a nation here, or I should say the consolidation of a nation. I think if you guys think a little bit, you'll realize precisely the connection of this situation to ours. One of the things that always interested me about Russian history is I think more than any other nation, Russia has faced almost the extermination of its entire existence, and not only recovered, but recovered very quickly in an almost superhuman way. But you have, now, you know my view of the so-called Mongol invasion, but I refer to that just for the sake of a point of reference. You had a rebuilding of the Russian state around Moscow. But what happened after Ivan III, Ivan the Great, you have a massive territorial expansion. You have a rapidly organized system of public administration. A huge army based on land ownership, a large fleet which existed far prior to Peter, a highly advanced field artillery and firearms industry, modern border fortresses, a system of federal highways, a postal service, a single code of laws, and an all-Russia monetary system. This period of recovery, we're talking about prior to the time of troubles, we're talking about a radical restructuring and rebirth of a society that had suffered untold dislocation. A centralization of the Russian nation comes from two men, Ivan III and Basil III. When I was in college, I had an obsession with Basil III for a reason that I don't fully understand. But when the Novgorod oligarchy was connected to Moscow in 1478, the chances of Russia going in the same direction as, say, Poland or the Italian states was ended. As I've said 1,000 times, and I'll say it 1,000 times more, historically speaking, European society, really any society, European society in particular has two choices. Either monarchy in some form or method, or oligarchy in some form. But Russia built what we would vaguely call a modern state or nation. Not that those things are the same, but in Russia they very much were. Before Spain or Britain. Spain united in 1479, roughly the same period of time. And Ferdinand II inherited Aragon, the death of his father. And in France, of course, Louis XI, founder of the modern monarchy, historians call it absolute, which is a ridiculous term. The only time that term is actually useful is when you refer to it as a matter of responsibility, not power. To think that one man could have absolute power over anything, including his own life, is ridiculous. And in Britain, of course, one of my favorite English monarchs, Henry VII, which is odd given that I'm an Irishman, became king in 1485, finally putting an end to the War of the Roses, and of course creating the Tudor system. Now, it's true that Russia wasn't proclaimed an empire formally until 1721, near the end of Peter's life, but Russia became an imperial state in the true sense of the term under Ivan III. In diplomatic documents, he was called Tsar, a term that is of great political significance. Now, the word Tsar, T-S-A-R in English, does not come from the Latin Caesar. That's a long-standing myth. It's actually a Persian term. The great historian Karamzin traces it to Babylon. The last syllable of names like Thalassar, Nabonassar, Salamansar, that last syllable, S-A-R, in the Persian language refers to the light, someone possessing the light in the sense of grace. The meaning of the name Tsar, that is S-A-R, Z-A-R, T-S-A-R, in Russian actually means the dawn. And in modern Russia, it would be Zarya, Z-A-R-Y-A, suggesting the sun. And you see it in Hebrew female names like Sarah, which means a noblewoman, or even the English sir, the respected person. Now, the name Caesar in the Latin comes from two parts, Caesar, as well as Lazar, Lassar, Elizar, names like this. The basis of the name Tsar, S-A-R-Z-A-R, is certainly much older than the name Caesar. It's shorter and easier phonetically, so we can affirm that the word Tsar, in the sense of a Russian monarch, does not come from Caesar, but it comes from a more ancient name of a man beloved by God, or even a god hero that once lived in the distant past. They both have a common root. But even more than that, the word Caesar, in the way it was used in the East, was a tributary monarch. Caesar was not emperor. The emperor was Basileus. Now, that means that when Ivan IV took the title Tsar in 1547, the point wasn't to claim that he was Caesar, therefore underneath an emperor, but he was putting himself on a par with the former rulers of Constantinople, ancient Rome, the Horde, the Bulgarian Kingdom, or the Holy Roman Empire. So Russia's an empire at least from 1547, or even from 1472, when Ivan III married Sofia Palaiologa, the niece and heiress of the last Byzantine Empire. Her father was Thomas Palaiologos, the younger brother of Constantine XI, the last monarch of the empire. but that would hardly lead to the adoption of the Caesar title, especially with her. But more than that, more was going on after that period of time, right after that period of time. You had more local tradition, such as corporate representation. One of the most famous was the Zemensky Sobor, or the Synod of the Land, resolve political issues, including the election of kings. From 1549 to 1684, the Sobor was convened once in a while, and it was based on corporate representation. The Sobor represented Russia's kind of feudal classes, for lack of a better term, in the categories of nobility, the high bureaucracy, the Senate and the clergy, and of course the commoners, merchants, townspeople, Cossacks. Assemblies could be summoned by the Tsar, the Patriarch, even the Duma, to decide pretty much anything. So over 135 years, but 60 of those were convened. The largest had 1,500 people involved, representing cities, suburbs, counties, social corporations. And you have, you know, estate representative institutions, you know, the Estates General in France, in the Netherlands, the Reichstag in Germany, the Cortes in Spain, the Siem in the Commonwealth of Poland, although not really as oligarchic as the latter. But in Russia, both using European and local tradition, it reached a very high level of sophistication. But the election of the monarch was one of its most significant functions. The most famous, of course, the election of Mikhail Romanov in 1613. But it also elected kings of the new dynasty in 1598, Boris Godunov. 1606, the kind of truncated election of Basil Shuisky, although problematic. And, of course, Mikhail himself. But it also approved the accession of heirs to the throne, 1584, with Fyodor. 1645, of course, Tsar Alexis. And 1682, which was the regency of Sophia. So from 1613 to 1622 was constantly in session. And it was very representative. It was a classic corporatist national system. Because each college, each group, sent its best people. More than that, you had what we would call a county, or a zemstvo, self-government. It became a tradition. Until the beginning of the 16th century, it existed in the form of public gatherings and related civilian institutions. Local self-government never disappeared. In 1539, Lina Glinskaya, mother of Ivan IV, wife of Basil III, launched herself a local government reform, introducing elective positions of local chiefs in the counties who conducted criminal proceedings on property crimes especially. And she also established a firm monetary policy and put literally the stamp of royal power on the currency. In 1550, the same Sobor created the Sudebnik, the judicial code. The government issued statutes of local self-government, the Zemensky reform of Ivan, and several types of posts of elected elders and judges were introduced. Peasant communes and urban guilds were recognized as independent legal entities. He established the central government, the Sobor itself, and the gathering of the nobility, the local level. These weren't necessarily established, but they were legally recognized. The Sudebnik provided for active participation. The representatives of local communities in court cases. You couldn't arrest a suspect unless you had the consent of the local community. Even the laws at the central level functioned only to the extent that the commune accepted them. And of course, parish life was also elective. Abbots of monasteries were always elective, until Peter the Great, of course. The representative of the traditional community, the Dyak, participated in judicial administration. You had self-government at every level. The Sudebnik had the rights of peasants, able to leave the landowner, their employer, after a certain payment. But most importantly, the 1550 Code liquidated the aristocracy's privileges, which, of course, meant an increase in state and royal power. It represented Ivan IV's victory over oligarchy, and the regime, in the broad sense, never forgave him for that. What people forget about Russia in this era, you talk about the era of exploration in the West, It existed on a far greater scale in the east. You're talking about an eighth of the Earth's land. Russia acquired huge new territories around the same time that the Western Europeans were looking in the other direction. The geographical exploration occurred around the same time. I mean, but it's even earlier. In 1364, Novgorod governor Alexander Abramovich made the first, at least documented, expedition to western Siberia and the polar Urals, discovering the Ob River, about 1,100 miles of its lower course. As a governor, he was an interesting guy. He climbed the Usa Mountain. He crossed the polar Urals, traveled down the Sobi and the Ob, went along to the Gulf. His other detachment ascended Shulgor Mountain, crossed the northern Urals, reached the Ob along the northern Sosva River. You're talking about thousands of square miles. In 1365, they returned. You're talking about roughly 900 miles of the Ob River. The Ob, of course, is, I believe, the fourth longest river in the world. People also forget the expeditions to Siberia. Now, this goes back to the late Middle Ages. But in less than a century, Russian explorers explored and conquered Siberia. From the campaign of the Cossack Ermak, Timofeev, in 1581, reaching the Pacific Ocean under Ivan Moskvitin in 1639, discovery of the Bering Strait by Dezhnev, 1648. Ultimately, the annexed territories in Siberia were about 8 million square miles. A huge area in a very short period of time. It was a massive undertaking. Of course, economically, what much of this comes down to is the concern with fur and timber. You're talking about the conquest of the feudal, sometimes Islamic, Khanates of the south too. The Khanate of Kazan had the forward base movement into the region. Ivan the Terrible had probably the most modern military in Europe, and he used the Stroganov family. They were oligarchs, but they clearly worked for the central government rather than in their own interests. They found out that could be profitable too, and then his grandsons, Nikita and Maxim, recruited Cossack fighters to wage war in the south on their behalf. That's where they elected Ermak, the famous Cossack who conquered the southern part of Siberia. You had, like you had in, among the natives in America and elsewhere, constant warfare among rival clans and tribes. You had guys down there who were claiming to be the descendant of Genghis, Kuchum Khan. All of the contemporary descriptions of Genghis show him as a white man, that is to say, with red hair and light skin, and gray eyes, as the Arabs would say. I don't know what gray eyes are, but I don't think I've ever seen those. But that comes up again and again, but only at the time. So some of these tribes got together to try to thwart Russia's expansion. Talked about in the 1570s, using the Cossacks, of course, and the Russians using the Cossacks to push forward. And Ermak's story in the Cossack movement in southern Siberia is extremely interesting. And it shows an extremely different approach to manifest destiny as you would have in America. Now, we all know some of that stuff is mythical, you know, the extermination and all that. But even still, it's very, very different in the Russian case. You didn't have a Russian, I mean, not the phrase manifest destiny, but something along those lines. And there were still Tartar forces sprinkled throughout the area. And you had, I mean, Ermak was one of the great conquerors and explorers of all time. But you did have a similar situation where some of the local tribes very quickly allied with the newcomers. I don't believe there was a substantial racial difference in this part of the world, unlike in North America. But the the Ustyak nation, for the most part, sided with Ermak. Ermak was an extremely charismatic leader, who then organized, along with the Cossacks, to build a Russian state in the area. And at some point, it was Ivan IV who declared him the hero of the nation, made him the Prince of Siberia, which, being a very intelligent man, he gave back to Ivan, and that remains part of his, part of the Tsar's title right up to the very end. The major problem that he had, of course, was supplies. Despite having strong alliances in the area, supplies continuously were an issue. But after Kazan was, the Khanate was conquered under Ivan IV, it became organized to the province of Perm. And it became the private investment, really, of the Stroganov clan. They expanded even farther and attacked the Islamic rulers in far south. And these conquests had a significant impact on Russian policy. It created the Siberian mentality that we know today. And really, prior to the Stroganovs, see, this is what happens when, you know, a family puts its wealth in the interest of the nation, puts its men in service at the interest of the nation, you still profit, but for a public good rather than your own good. It used to be that defense was a concern. The top priority in Ivan's Siberian policy was to repel the Tartar hordes in the area. And the central government was not really involved, unless the tribes there entered into Russian territory. That Ermak changed all this. It showed that Tartars could be put on the defensive, and Russia could establish herself in the east. We would call it Central Siberia today, but at the time it was the Far East. Ermak gained support of Ivan, and really it was a reinforcement sent from Moscow that permitted him to conquer the area. He was killed by the by Kuchum Khan in 1584 in an ambush. But Ermak's pioneering established the new system there and allowed it to exist, largely because of the friendship and tribute from the local peoples. And troops were sent in the future with the understanding that they had to maintain good relationships with the local nation, especially the Ustyak people. But no system could have worked unless that was the case. Ermak wisely recognized that these were ununified territories, that most of these people were vassals. They were very different, if not in race and everything else, from the Russians. Many paid tribute just to avoid trouble. But Ermak's unique strength was in recognizing this bigger picture to his advantage and identifying and using his charisma and support of ethnic self-determination to support the Russian cause. Russia did not engage in any kind of extermination or slavery of the indigenous peoples, many of whom were white anyway. All the Siberian people survived even to the present day. And Russian colonists assisted in the development of these peoples and ended their constant warfare that destroyed any potential that they might have. But the point of all this is what Russia was doing militarily. The myth that somehow they were behind Western Europe is just that. Firearms and field guns appeared at the end of the 14th century. I mean, 1382 at the very latest. But really before 1376, at least by indirect data. Around the same time as in, it came in Western Europe from North Italy. Field artillery and firearms appeared in Moscow during the reign of Ivan III in Novgorod and Tver in the 1440s. But in the 15th century, Russian artillery was seen as the most advanced and best developed in the world. And it's proven by the fact that you have a lot of unique, almost super weapons that were being produced at the time. The Tsar cannon, the largest caliber cannon in history, weighed 2,400 pounds and had a caliber of almost 900 millimeters. It was cast in 1586. But it wasn't the first among the heavy weapons that Russia was pioneering. The Peacock, weighing about 1,500 pounds with 550 millimeters as its caliber, was cast in 1488. And it proves the advanced level of Russian weaponry, the foundry system at the time. Cannon production in Russia was the most advanced in Europe. The cannon yard in Moscow was founded in 1475. With the assistance of the Italian engineer Aristotle Trivanti. And these were mass-produced. And, of course, you need to have a scientific foundation for that to work. The modern wedge lock and piston lock were created in Russia in the 16th century. The world's first rifled guns, or I should say, rifles appeared in Russia. Russian gunsmiths began to produce the kind of the screw rifling and the barrel bore. The arsenal of the Russian army then, you had, they created the mobile field fortification, the Gulegorod, or the, I guess, wandering city, the collapsible mobile formation, a fortification, in the form of large shields mounted on carts and allowed firing from cover, which was far more advanced than the Wagenburg of the Germans or the Vozova Hradba of the Western Slavs. Essentially, what they did is they created this mobile fortification from these wall-sized prefabricated shields with holes. And you would install it on wheels or sleds, sort of a development, a more advanced version of the wagon fort concept. The Gulegorod developed a very popular fortification that in Eastern Europe, especially in the steppe nations, where you had this flat landscape that provided no natural shelter. And one of the first descriptions is from Giles Fletcher, the English ambassador to Russia, who explained this in his 1591 on the Russian Commonwealth. And this was used on a wide scale in the battles in Kazan, 1438-1552, and the Cossacks also used this. And the famous Battle of Mulodi, which ended the expansion of the Crimean Khanate into Russia. The Cossacks used this all the time. We mentioned Ermak in Kazan. Really before him, Russian army for the first time used artillery-filled siege towers. Ivan Vorotkov, military engineer, one of the greatest of all time. The fortresses in the 15th centuries were the most advanced of the era. But I mean, even the Kremlin in the 15th century, the world's largest classical medieval fortress with a closed perimeter and the second longest existing building in Europe. But the system, and Russia had to build this because it had these huge, long borders where they needed to keep out extremely hostile forces. Russian science and Russian development existed primarily for military defense. It was one of the first broad concepts that I learned in Russian history a long time ago. So, say, in Britain or Portugal or the Netherlands, it was profit in the building of, you know, a commercial empire. In Russia, they were forced to build their scientific establishment dedicated to defense and military operations. And this is why the Russians were the most advanced in these giant stone fortresses, which were done under Ivan and Basil III, especially on the southern border. It was absolutely necessary. The survival of the nation depended on it. But in 1551, in less than 4 weeks, in preparation for the siege of Kazan, the Savoy support fortress was built. Again, from prefabricated blocks transported from elsewhere on an island near Kazan. And it was a secret operation in construction overseen by the same Vorotkov. He built in 1552 a 30-foot-high siege tower in one night. Now, the older siege towers were obsolete once artillery was created, but Vorotkov created something very different. The new type of siege engine was now more like a what was called, at least in Russian, a battery tower, because it was built for the bombardment of the city, and he constructed it to hold 10 large-caliber cannon and 50 lighter guns, and was the first of its kind. This meant you could concentrate artillery fire in a section of the wall of a city, and this is what shattered Tatar resistance in southern Russia. Now, they had to wipe out the forward cannons of the other side first, but in the Tatar case, that wasn't that big of a deal. It was too big of a target otherwise. But the fortified defensive line in 16th century in Russia was globally famous. The Russian Great Line was about 900 miles long, from the headwaters of the Oka River to the Volga, the largest of its kind. The only thing could compare to it is the Roman line, and together with later fortified lines, the system of fortifications of the southern steppe border, the only thing comes close to it, really, other than Rome, is the Great Wall. The Great Wall of China didn't have the features that the Russian Great Wall had. On sea, it was no different. But there you have to go to Novgorod. This is very different. I mean, they're Russians, they're Slavs, they're Europeans, they're Orthodox. But they had a different form of development because they were not touched by the Mongol Wars. They created, in the 11th century, the first icebreakers. It was kind of an egg shape, it was called the Kochi. It had a reinforced hull and other design features that made it possible to kind of squeeze up onto the ice and then break it through the weight of the ship. And it led to the squeezing of the vessel on the surface, just in case it was slashed by ice fragments like, you know, the Titanic, or it could be allowed to be pulled onto the ice without damage and could be dragged to clear water. But this is the icebreaker that allowed the Russians, the Pomors in particular, to master the Arctic. And the explorers that we discussed in Siberia and the Far East were only possible by the creation of the first icebreaker, especially when they discovered the Bering Strait in 1648. But it goes back to the 11th century. The White Sea shores were first settled. And straight from there on, polar navigation was developed. And the private Russian civil fleet in the Arctic seas in this period of time that we're talking about numbered up to, at least just in 1 year, about 7,400 medium-sized and small ships. The notion that Peter the Great built the Russian fleet is simply not true. But by the 17th century, the Siberian rivers were conquered by the Kochi and was part of the conquest of Siberia. Now, not only did Peter the Great not create the Russian fleet, he actually damaged it. Because in 1715, during the Great Northern War, Peter the Great actually put out a ukaz, or an order, banning this design, stating that only new style ships, that is, ships from, you know, places like Denmark, those designs, were allowed to be used. Anything traditional and Russian had to be backwards and bad, having no idea the nature of Russian shipbuilding up until this period of time. And he meant, really, that merchant marine ships had to also be used for military purposes. And the Kochi and its anti-ice features didn't suit this. So this notion that he's this modernizer is nonsense. He banned Russian technology he never understood, showing quite possibly that he's not the same Peter that left on the Great Embassy. Now, it wasn't until the 19th century that this was refounded and the Kochi system was used for our modern icebreakers, but it was the Middle Ages in Novgorod, in Pskov, that created this technology. But these poor modern Novgorodian fleets existed from the 11th century. You have this throughout Russian history. But as is typical for Russia, everything is driven by military necessity, especially once the empire was established by Ivan III. And the military organization, obviously, is a huge part of this. The army numbered, by the middle of the 16th century, about 100,000. You had maybe 25,000 landowners who needed to send at least one or two armed men. But that also included about 10,000 Tatars, 20,000 archers and Cossacks, and then 4,000 mercenaries. So by 1651, combat ready, maybe 133,000. By 1680, 164,000. That does not include roughly 50,000 Cossacks from Ukraine. In other words, Russia had to be able to build, field, and supply an army large enough and well-equipped enough to fight on several fronts at once, because they have to protect the largest and longest land borders in Europe. And this led to a revolution in Russian government, where you had the military servitors, landowners, in charge of the rank order, artillery, the streltsy, the elite forces, the stables, and all the rest. And for the first time, you had well-developed military branches, infantry, cavalry, artillery, engineering, and a regimental system, and you had standardized military textbooks. Just as importantly, you have the Strelets, the Streletsky, founded in 1550. These were permanent soldiers. You read any general history book in Russia, they come up again and again, especially in the early reign of Peter. They were one of the first to wear a regular uniform. They were the word, you know, the Streltsy, the Strelets, is word for archer. But by the 16th century, they were special forces. When they were founded in 1550, they were essentially special forces in the modern sense of that term. And this force was, you know, 1550, 1545. They were armed with the mounted long rifle. You see them in the Kazan siege. They were recruited from the free tradesmen, from the towns. And for them, military service, being special forces, was not only lifelong, but it was also hereditary. They guarded the Kremlin, and of course, regular military operations wherever they were needed. They performed certain police functions, even fire brigade functions. People like Adam Olerius, foreign travelers, spoke about them at great length. Many of them, by the way, were also old believers, and this is why Peter I had them destroyed, because they were the first, as an organized force, to oppose him, to oppose what he was all about, and they knew his revolutionary intent very early on. Unfortunately, their rebellions, which were several, turned out to be their undoing. Peter, therefore, typical of him, imported a whole lot of foreigners to take their place. Military reforms of the 17th century brought in both the dragoons and the hussars, which are horsemen. That dragoon was a foot soldier. Well, really, he was on horseback, but mostly a foot soldier, while the hussar, of course, more aristocratic, was strictly fighting on horseback. But by the time Peter destroyed most of his army, especially the elite forces, he had to bring in foreigners made up about 50% of the force, which makes sense given Peter's priorities. The Russian army still won most of the wars and battles in the second half of the 15th to the 17th century. Obviously, at a colossal expansion of the state's territory, but it came at a high price. Still, Russia fought and defeated Swedes, Lithuanians, Poles, not to mention Turks and other forces in the south. That, by the way, were not exactly savages. The Persians were no one to be trifled with. Now, it's true, as I've said before, Russia, like America, maybe only two countries that could be purely autarkic if absolutely necessary. Russia still is not exactly known for its trading regime, but back then, it was well advanced. They exported very high demand goods in Europe. The typical list, you know, furs, honey, wax, river pearls, that kind of thing. The best leather, the Yust, were Russia's main exports. And of course, importantly, Muscovite glass. Russia has a lot of mica, and this was used as a substitute for, you know, glass at the time was very expensive to make and maintain. Russia also exported alabaster, another glass substitute, and this earned the Russian state a huge income. But all of this, of course, requires a substantial scientific foundation. All of this generally states that Russia could not have been backward in the sense that the British and at least a handful of German propagandists tried to promote centuries later. Pearl fishing was a big deal. The export of furs, we've already mentioned it. This is the reason that Russia opened up the Far East. The period of time we're talking about here, you had the global cooling development, the so-called Little Ice Age. So Russian furs are in greater demand. The growing number of noble and merchant classes in Europe increased the demand even further. But in the West, only the wealthy could afford fur. In Russia, that was certainly not the case. One of the reasons that Russia came to annex Siberia was this industry. And it just simply advanced, almost to the extent that silks advanced in the Middle Ages. Russia had a gigantic amount of exports, both finished and raw, that made Russia an extremely, not to mention to the West, but also to the East. Russia was also a middleman for like Bukhara silk fabrics and Persian oil. And most importantly, no matter what the West would say about Russia and condemn her, they knew that since the banking industry was deliberately repressed, you had a highly rational and stable monetary policy. That meant that the Russian cost of living stayed stable while the standard of living went up. So Russia had a detailed, well-developed knowledge of history and geography, military affairs, similar applied disciplines, certainly in mathematics and physics. And this was done in the applied sciences, things like cartography, navigation, optics, and ballistics. Mentioning the concept of the expansion to the East is that the Russian scientific establishment created gigantic, accurate maps of the region. You're talking about millions of square miles, thousands of miles of these rivers for the first time, and of course the technology necessary to conquer these areas and maintain these areas. Some of these Khanates were fairly civilized. Some of them were supported by European powers, as I've dealt with elsewhere. This is no small undertaking. But in rejecting the notion of the so-called independent banking system, Russia was able to shield herself from the Western European, what we call the price revolution. Russia had its own sources of gold and silver, not really discovered, exploited till the end of the 17th century. The Nerchinsk factories in Transbaikalia. But because of all of this and state banking rather than private banking, Russian monetary policy was always very stable. The price revolution was essentially, it's a high rate of inflation over 150 years. Prices in Western Europe went up about 600%. Now, that means maybe an inflation rate of 1.5, something like that, percent a year, depending on the decade, which is relatively low by modern standards, very high by standards back then. So gold and silver coming in from the New World flows through Spain, increasing Spanish prices. Then this spreads over all of Western Europe because Spain had a huge balance of payments deficit. So now you have an enlarged monetary supply. And we're talking about the era of discovery in North America. That means higher prices in most European countries with an influx of gold and silver, massive population growth, urbanization brought upon by capitalism. The price revolution was perpetuated way beyond what it would have been otherwise. In other words, you had too many people with too much money in circulation without the production to absorb it. Therefore, you had inflation. That means rising prices at a time where rents were fixed, and therefore smaller landowners especially were destroyed. Now, rent was not fixed in Spain, which meant that landowners could raise their rent and replace their tenants based on the ability to pay. But for everyone else, it led to destruction. Complete enforced poverty. Any fixed income, any small rent, anyone who lived on this kind of thing was completely destroyed. It couldn't keep up with rising Spanish prices. Commodity prices went through the roof, so small landowners, etc., couldn't function anymore. This is one of the causes of Western oligarchy. It's hard to tell with the peasantry. The records are iffy. But this is one of the things that force a mass immigration to the towns. But Spanish enterprise in the second half of the 16th century, the situation got worse. Spanish enterprises became less and less competitive. The only one that really dominated, again, this is, has to do with the creation of oligarchy, it was the Republic of Genoa. Almost a pure oligarchy, gambled on this price increase. They invested their money in the crown and the Jewish tax farmers, Spanish revenue, and they even settled in Spain, as is well known, and they married into the local nobility, and they monopolized much of the high-level trade in the area. So long as the colonies in Latin America were sending silver and gold to Spain, that meant the Italian Republic of Genoa was able to amass a massive amount of wealth, and it meant that they became a huge credit market, and other cities, even in Italy, saw their own specie being drained into Genoese coffers. It might not be going too far to say this is where modern oligarchy came from, and in fact may well be the very nature of modernity as such. Now, in Russia, the commercial estate did grow. Many enterprises were founded. You had corporate representation, however, of merchants. We mentioned the Stroganov clan, which completely built Siberia. But Russia's development was extremely different. Russia didn't experience the problems of overpopulation and the unsanitary conditions in Western European cities. Russian lands were not affected by plague epidemics, as it was in the West. The Russian population grew faster than in Europe, proving that conditions were more important, possibly, than the actual plague itself. Now, of course, the Middle Ages came to an end with the Black Death pandemic, and it continued to show up again and again and again. European population went down by a third, at least. But in Russia, by 1500, this simply didn't happen. There were some deaths in Russia, nothing like it was in the West. You didn't have mass urbanization, and you had a fairly low population density, meaning that the epidemic didn't spread nearly as rapidly. You also had a better diet, and accessibility of natural sources of vitamins for the general population. Not to say anything against Western Europeans whatsoever at the time, but because their cities weren't forcibly inflated by this mass rush of people like you had in Western Europe, you had a higher level of sanitation. I mean, Western European cities grew so fast that they simply couldn't keep up. And large European cities were known for their stench and their dirt, their disease. They developed things like, you know, shoes with high soles or wide-brimmed hats for protection from stuff thrown from windows. Protection against fleas, unwashed bodies. They developed flea traps and perfumes, all of this. This wasn't the case, of course, in rural areas. But city dwellers just got used to this. Capitalism forced a huge migration to urban areas. I shouldn't even say capitalism, just commercial revolution in general. Forced a massive exodus from the rural areas into urban areas, creating big cities quickly. But still, foreign travelers in Russia were amazed at the bathing tradition there that comes from Scandinavia. Not to mention the health and growth of Muscovites. Muscovites were a bit bigger physically than in Western Europe. Traditions like dousing with cold water, bathing in ice holes, stuff like that, and a very, very good diet. Foreign travelers were very concerned with this and found it worthwhile. Russian cities were cleaner. They weren't affected by commercialism because, among other things, the state was too powerful, meaning that the commercial class was put in a guild that was self-governed, but under ultimate royal control. Russian cities were lighter, they were more spacious. The streets were wider because they needed to remove snow in winter. Typical Russian buildings were large urban estates without the tall houses hanging over the streets. And Russian cities had better clean water for both drinking and washing, given the climate and the very snowy winters. again, as typical in Russia, new cities, science, the development of social life came from military necessity, not necessarily profit. New cities were formed not because of the commercial revolution, but from fortified towns on the steppe border. Military necessity, not commercial life, created the Russian town. This is partially why Russia's cities were the most developed and cleaner, far cleaner than elsewhere, because they didn't have to deal with this rush of people. This is extremely important. Now, some of this necessity, I can't get to it all today. I'm not sure if I'm going to do a part two or not. But after the death of Ivan III, a bit afterwards, we're talking maybe the beginning of the 16th century, the Khanate of the Crimea became very powerful. The Horde, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, became allies. That was a potent alliance against Russia. The Ottoman state also received tribute from Crimea. It was a constant disturbing Russian life from Crimean raids in the 1570s. The Crimean Turkish invasion, in fact, led to Russia, Moscow being burnt. But it was only the Battle of Melody, which I mentioned before, in 1572, that saved Russia from submission to Turkey. This battle doesn't get talked about very much, but it's one of the reasons. I mean, can you imagine if Turkey had defeated the Russian army, or the Crimean Turkish alliance? But because of the conflict with Crimea, the maritime communication with Greece and Italy was disrupted. Under Ivan the Terrible, the Livonian Wars were going on. They were draining Russian resources. So Divlet the First Gudei, the Khan of the Crimea, wanted to take advantage of temporary Russian weakness. And because they had burnt Moscow just recently, they wanted to do it again. They did it first in 1571. That was the so-called Great Moscow Fire. But a very large army with suspiciously elite equipment, and I say that because it was coming from Western Europe, crossed the Oka River and moved towards Moscow. But their intelligence didn't realize that Ivan the Terrible had been preparing for this and was using all of these technological developments that I mentioned already. Russia was able, given the war that was going on elsewhere, Russia was able to field maybe 20,000 men. And the Crimeans and Turks had more than twice that. You had three armies. And the strategy was to engage in a lot of close quarter fighting, because Crimean archers were very elite. High quality Russian artillery and the different fortification methods did tremendous damage to them. They used the Glegorod to create fortifications to the rear of their invading force, which trapped them and cut off their supplies. A handful limped back to the Crimea after the battle was over. The Khan himself barely escaped alive. They killed his son, two sons, actually, and a grandson, throwing Crimea into a crisis as a result. So here again, Russia's badly outnumbered, faced a well-organized, suspiciously professional force, and destroyed them. In fact, Russia was such a threat because of this that you had organized. I mentioned this in my Third Rome, my very first book, how Western European powers got together to prevent any foreign scholar or scientist or inventor or anything else from settling in Russia. The most famous case was that of Hans Schlitt in 1548. He had a train of about 300 people. They were traveling to Livonia from Verdun, but were held in Lübeck. They were held in prison there, which caused an international crisis. This was a very large group of scholars who had been invited into Russia to assist them in military, you know, all kinds of things. But it's a testament to her growth and power that Western European powers demanded that they be arrested in Lübeck and kept there to keep them from continuing the development of Russia. This occurs, again, in the late 19th century, where Britain saw both Russian development and Prussian development as a gigantic threat. We've spoken about this ad nauseum on this show. The problem is, trying to compare Russian development to Western European development is problematic for a whole bunch of reasons. There was a brief period of time where Russia, of course, fell behind for some very objective reasons. For one thing, of course, Western populations are about 10 times, I mean, after the recovery from the Black Death, creation of the Renaissance and the Baroque eras, 10 times out of Russia once they recovered. The heritage of antiquity was better preserved in the West, especially after the fall of Constantinople. Development of typography began earlier because of the German Reformation. But mass book printing appeared in Russia really only in the 1550s. But even mostly liturgical, like everything else, because of the crisis and the battles over book correction. That's not necessarily the old believer. That was not about book correction. That's silly. But you did have a crisis over it, unrelated to that, that caused mass production of books to be temporarily put on hold. And so you only have secular books being printed en masse in the 1630s. But both because of the Hussites in, you know, Czechia and Martin Luther before this, I mean, sorry, you know, in the beginning of the 17th century, before the Russian case, you had an explosion of book publication because of the Protestant stress on the Bible being really the only book. And so it became of immense significance. And the Hussites were doing something very similar. But Russia was outside the Latin-speaking world. One of the great things about Latin, and this would have been the case with Greek, but, you know, Byzantium had fallen. But Russia was part of the Greek-speaking, Byzantine, post-Byzantine worlds. And that was weakened terribly. I mean, from 1204 onward, of course, middle of the 15th century, fall of the city. But it was precisely at the time of the rapid development of science that Russian communication with Europe was complicated, largely due to military conflict. So it was a matter of timing. I mean, Byzantium's fall, internal Russian instability, and then not to mention wars with outside powers, corresponded almost exactly with the development of modern thought, for better or for worse, in Western Europe. So these are extremely significant. And this is right around the time of Ivan III, the war with Crimea, and then, of course, the Livonian War, which I do not have time to get in now, unfortunately. Livonian War is one of my favorite topics these days. And just as important as all this, the notion that a centralized state being necessary for survival was the entire impetus behind everything in the economy, science, urban development, and the organization of social life and culture. Unfortunately, the Livonian War from 1558 to 1583 drained Russian manpower and money, and again, cut Russia off from a lot of profitable developments. This is also roughly the same time as the war with Crimea. So Russian resources are being drained precisely at the time where you have revolutions in thinking in Western Europe. On the one hand, this is a very positive thing because it isolated Russia from what we call the Enlightenment, which we can thank God for every day. It's one of the reasons that Russia is worth studying in the first place. But from a purely secular point of view, it meant that Russia then had to play catch-up afterwards because this science was based entirely around commercial power, using the state as its bodyguard against its rivals. This had nothing to do with Russian development, which is based on something else. It has everything to do with whether or not oligarchy will rule over the common good. In fact, while it's very simplistic, it's not crazy to approach world history with this axiom. because one or the other has to rule. They can't exist at the same time. So you have someone like Ivan the Terrible in Russia doing the same thing as Eric the 14th of Sweden, one of my favorite monarchs in Scandinavian history. He also was at war with the same forces that Ivan's at war with, the same forces that we're at war with today. In fact, Eric the 14th was so dedicated to the destruction of oligarchy in Sweden that when he was off on campaign, he refused to let elites rule the state. He put his secretary, Jeroen Prysen, in charge of the administration. The Privy Council, which, I mean, to use an English phrase, was one of the vehicles of oligarchy. That was effectively replaced by Prysen. And the oligarchy had been ousted from Eric's court and replaced by commoners who were highly talented and also very loyal because the king was the reason that they were promoted. Prysen was actually the prosecutor of Eric. And this was an outrage to the oligarchy, who believed that they have a right to rule through their money and land ownership, rather than actual ability. The difference between Sweden and Russia is, unlike Ivan IV, the oligarchs did rebel against him and replace him with the more cooperative John III. And it's exactly when John III took over where Russian-Swedish relations fell to pieces. Because John III married Catherine of Lithuania, who had, for political reasons, had rejected Ivan IV earlier. In essence, the overthrow of Eric, the election of John III, or the installation of John III, his marriage with the oligarchs in Poland-Lithuania, almost was a means of solidifying oligarchy in both, in really in Northern Europe. It created an oligarchic, or maybe, to be nice about it, an aristocratic international in Northern Europe against Russia. John even tried to make peace with Rome for the sake of building this oligarchic coalition with the Polish elites. The reign of Eric has not been dealt with effectively amongst nationalists and royalists elsewhere. And his relationships with Ivan and the nature of oligarchy in both countries, which were not all that dissimilar. Unfortunately, they had two very different fates. And as always, Eric's considered mentally ill. Anyone who fights oligarchy will be considered mentally ill, crazy, a tyrant, and propaganda. Of course, history being written by the victors. Well, I want to finish up some of this next week, because what we're talking about here is the building of a nation, the building of a strong royalist national Christian state. Very, very different from the politics of the West. And this is certainly worth discussing for the sake of our own situation and the simple fact of life, that we could either live by our passions, that is to say, what motivates the oligarchy, or we live according to reason for the common good, what motivates monarchy at their best. We'll continue this next time, everyone. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.